Chapter 29. The Voice Among the Trees. Partly from the damping influence of this alarm, partly to rest Silver and the sick folk, the whole party sat down as soon as they had gained the brow of the ascent. The plateau being somewhat tilted toward the west, this spot on which we paused commanded a wide prospect on either hand. Silver, as he sat, took bearings with his compass. "There are three tall trees," said he, "about in the right line from Skeleton Island. Spyglass Shoulder, I take it, means that lower point there. It's child's play to find the stuff now. I've half a mind to dine first." "I don't feel well," growled Morgan. "Thinking of Flint, I think it were, has done me." "Ah, well, my son, you praise your stars he's dead," said Silver. "He were an ugly devil," cried a third pirate, with a shudder. "That blue in the face, too." "That was how the rum took him," added Mary. Ever since they had found the skeleton and got upon this train of thought, they had spoken lower and lower, and they had almost got to whispering by now, so that the sound of their talk hardly interrupted the silence of the wood. All of a sudden, out of the middle of the trees in front of us, a thin, high, trembling voice struck up the well-known air and words, "15 men on the dead man's chest, yo-ho-ho, and a bottle of rum." I have never seen men more dreadfully affected than the pirates. The color went from their six faces like enchantment. Some leaped to their feet, some clawed hold of others. Morgan groveled on the ground. "It's Flint," cried Mary. The song had stopped as suddenly as it began, broken off, you would have said, in the middle of a note, as though someone had laid his hand upon the singer's mouth. Coming so far through the clear, sunny atmosphere among the green treetops, I thought it had sounded airily and sweetly, and the effect on my companions was the stranger. "Come," said Silver, struggling with his ashen lips to get the word out. "This won't do. This is a rum start, and I can't name the voice, but it's someone skylarking, someone that's flesh and blood." His courage had come back as he spoke, and some of the color to his face along with it. Already the others had begun to lend an ear to this encouragement, and were coming a little to themselves, when the same voice broke out again. Not this time singing, but in a faint, distant hail, that echoed fainter among the clefts of the spyglass. "Darby McGraw," it wailed, for that is the word that best describes the sound. "Darby McGraw," again and again, then rising a little higher, and with an oath, "Fetch aft the rum, Darby." The buccaneers remained rooted to the ground, their eyes starting from their heads. Long after the voice had died away, they still stared in silence, dreadfully before them. "That fixes it," gasped one. "Let's go." "They were his last words," moaned Morgan. "His last words above board." Dick had his Bible out and was praying volubly. He had been well brought up, had Dick, before he came to sea and fell among bad companions. Still, Silver was unconquered. I could hear his teeth rattle in his head, but he had not yet surrendered. "Nobody on this here island ever heard of Darby," he muttered. "Not one but us that's here." And then, making a great effort, "Shipmates," he cried, "I'm here to get that treasure, and I'll not be beat by man nor devil. I never was feared of Flint in his life, and by the powers I'll face him dead. There's 700,000 pounds, not a quarter of a mile from here. When did ever a gentleman of fortune show his stern to that much dollars? For just a boozy old seaman with a blue mug, and him dead, too." But there was no sign of reawakening courage in his followers, rather, indeed, of growing terror at the irreverence of his words. "Belay there, John," said Mary. "Don't cross a spirit." And the rest were all too terrified to reply. They would have run away had they dared, but fear kept them together, and kept them close by John, as if his daring helped them. He, on his part, had pretty well fought his weakness down. "Spirit, well, maybe," he said. "But there's one thing not clear to me. There was an echo. Now, no man ever seen a spirit with a shadow. Well, then what's he doing with an echo, I should like to know? That ain't natural, surely." This argument seemed weak enough to me, but you can never tell what will affect the superstitious, and to my wonder, George Mary was greatly relieved. "Well, that's so," he said. "You've a head upon your shoulders, John, and no mistake.